Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Sabbath School from Home. Very glad you've chosen to join us for this discussion. My name's Cameron.
G'day. Also glad you've joined us. I'm Ken.
Yeah, and I'm Lachlan. Definitely glad that you've joined us. I was just sharing with Luke...
Well, you were doing that in an amazing way, Lachlan, because he's not actually on the podcast with us today.
No, that's right. I was just sharing in the absence of Luke, but with Cam and Ken, I was just sharing that for reasons that are not at all obvious to us, the last month set a new monthly download record for this podcast. It's not growing anywhere near as exponentially as the COVID infections that caused us to start the podcast, but it's also not fading away. So we're glad that you're listening.
Yeah. It's very good. Now, one of the things that we ask for from our listeners is if they ever wish they can send us some feedback on our discussions to sabbathschoolfromhome@gmail.com. And in particular, I'd be very interested for people to let me know what they think. Now, first of all, for anyone who's not Adventist, we loosely follow the Seventh-day Adventist lesson quarterly. We all happen to be Seventh-day Adventists. We hope our discussions are of wider interest than that. But if anyone of our listeners does want to share what they think the principal idea is from this week's lesson, we would be very glad to know, because we don't have any idea.
We like some of the key words. Ooh. The title has great words. Love.
The title is fabulous. The central issue, love or selfishness? Great. Really good. Then we look at the first, well, Monday, and the heading is Christians Providentially Preserved. Now, I'm just, it seems it's a start of a non sequitur. Faithful amid persecution. We're almost complete with the non sequitur. Caring for the community. Ah, here we go. We're back at love. And then Thursday, a legacy of love.
Even within that, though, Ken, and it's not like those other topics are not worth discussing, but they're kind of like topics that you could write a whole quarter on. So is love and selfishness, and it doesn't. I'm not quite sure why so many ideas had to be conflated into one week. But even within Thursday's discussion, Ken, there's some very interesting ways questions are posed. Do you want to share with us, Ken, some of the questions?
Here's my favourite question, and we're going to go to the passage for this week. But the passage for this week that we're going to read is 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 through to 21. And the question that's asked in relation to the last of those verses, and I'll just read it now, and it says, "And he has given us this command, whoever loves God must also love his brother." Interesting that there's a real... correlation between that and the greatest command that was spoken about in Luke 10 and the other passages with Jesus, isn't there? Because whoever loves God, so there's the love God, must also love his brother. There's the love your neighbour as yourself. So wonderful connection there. Of course, it's obvious, is it not, that the principal question that arises from that is, how does that passage reveal Satan's challenge against the government of God in the great controversy?
I'm sorry for laughing.
very naively thought, Ken, that it was giving me advice on how to deal with that person at work who annoys me, or someone who's not treating me well.
No. It's very clearly dealing with Satan's challenge against the government of God in the great controversy. I don't know, really. Anyway, sorry, lesson authors. I don't think you've hit the mark on this one.
Well, it could just be that our minds are thinking in the wrong direction, but yeah, we're struggling.
So we should read this passage, shouldn't we?
Yeah. It's a really, really great passage.
Are you going to start for us, Cam?
Starting at verse 7?
Yes.
"Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him.
This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us."
And God has given us his Spirit as proof that we live in him and he in us. Furthermore, we have seen with our own eyes and now testify that the Father sent his Son to be the Saviour of the world. All who declare that Jesus is the Son of God have God living in them, and they live in God. We know how much God loves us, and we have put our trust in his love. God is love, and all who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. And as we live in God, our love grows more perfect. So we will not be afraid on the day of judgment, but we can face him with confidence because we live like Jesus here in this world.
There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. If anyone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother.
As I said, I think it's a great passage. I will point out that the regular combination and repetition of love and live can present a tongue twister.
But there's a real... This is one of the things that I find quite exciting. There was a... one of the desires that I have experienced over the years is to experience God. How do we live life with God? To want an experience with him. And here we have a very clear articulation of life with God. Indeed, you can talk about proofs of the existence of God and that sort of thing. But here is God's existence, we are told. And it's not some abstraction. It is fundamentally that he lives in our love and our love for each other. That is where he exists.
Yeah.
That doesn't require a belief in some abstract belief. It doesn't require mere conceptualization. In fact, it can exist independent of any conception of God.
Well, empirically, it does. There are people who are very selfless in love who may not have a clear picture of God. But this passage would suggest that they actually do have a very clear picture of God in the most important sense. There's a passage in The Ascent of Rum Doodle. Now, Lachlan is familiar with this, Ken. I don't think you are.
No.
I shall have to buy you a copy.
Thank you.
The Ascent of Rum Doodle is a satire, very much in the style of Three Men in a Boat, but it satirises the Victorian exploration epic. You know, we were 30 days in the blizzard and had to eat our porters and, you know, whatever. No one eats any porters, but, you know, that sort of, you know,
that's
we ate the sledge dogs and, you know, it's that sort of thing. And it's a bunch of about 11 British explorers who are completely, unknowingly, totally inept and at the mercy at every stage to the skills of their porters. And at the same time, they maintain a very well caricatured, condescending attitude towards these porters. These porters would make first-rate mountaineers if they had a bit of training. It's very good satire. And the spoiler is that they climbed the wrong mountain. So the expedition is on the verge of failure. Except while they're sitting on top of the wrong mountain, they look across at Rum Doodle, the mountain they're meant to be climbing, and they notice that there's an encampment of about 50 people on top of it. And this turns out to be due to an error in their translator, who's appalling, who's meant to be an expert in such things, who has inadvertently told the porters while they were up climbing the mountain, instead of moving their base camp closer to the base of the mountain, he inadvertently told them to move base camp to the summit of the mountain. And so now that base camp is on top of the mountain, the expedition is a success. I'm way off topic now, but it's too good not to talk. But that gives a sense of the mood, and it is full of humour of this type. The next day we set off. Shoot went first with, so he's the photographer, and then the doctor, and then the porters went, and then you got about a 10-minute explanation of the order. Meanwhile, I brought up the rear, meditating on the role of leader. So it's a beautiful disconnect. Oh, meditating on the responsibilities of leadership is, I think, the phrase that's used. There is that sense of disconnect that the author here is fighting against. You know, you say you love God.
Mm.
So you're sitting there at the back of the expedition meditating on leadership. Well, who cares? Mm. There's someone who's right in front of you. Who could be loved. There's also a very subtle reversal of what is often brought out as a sort of platitudinous, solve-all piece of advice. So long as you're close with God, the friendship will work. So long as you're close with God, the marriage will work. So long as you're close with God, you'll find a solution to this. So long as you're close to God, you will treat other people well. That is not, in fact, what the author is saying in this passage. The author is saying, and you were saying, Ken, how it's so difficult to know, how do I live with God? How do I be close to God? And the author here is saying, John is saying, well, actually, it's pretty easy. If you are loving, then even though it might feel ephemeral, God is a fundamental reality to your experience.
I mean, that's the key thought in verse 16, the second half of verse 16. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him. So if you live in love, you experience the life of God. You are living in him and he is in you.
Yeah. And further on, there's another phrase.
Is it verse 12? No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us.
It was verse 13. By this we know that we abide in him. So we know that we are living in God. Is that the first passage you read, Ken?
The first one you read.
Okay.
No, the first one was verse 16.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it seems like every verse is a good verse to choose on this theme. But it is an interesting reversal because you say, oh, so long as I have my picture of God correct, then that will automatically flow out into the rest of my life. But what is being suggested here is a reversal. Look at your life. Are you loving people? Because if you're not, your picture of God is not correct. The God you have a relationship is an imaginary thing. And that answers the question of how do you cope with people who perpetrate awful crimes in God's name.
Yeah.
So you say, well, actually, they think, if you talk to them, they think they have a clear picture of God that's telling them to destroy this village or to suicide bomb or to do a mass shooting or whatever it is. They think that, but they are obviously deceived because the measure of whether your picture of God is correct is whether you are loving people well. So the concrete thing is actually the thing we should be focusing on. So you say, oh, it's so hard to know if I'm connected. Am I really connected? Do I have a person? Is my relationship with God personal enough? You know, once you start worrying down that rabbit hole, you can go a long way. But actually, stopping and thinking, okay, in the last 24 hours and the next 24 hours, who am I having trouble loving? How did I do? What am I missing about God because I reacted in that way or I chose to do this? And that is, I think, much easier to cope with. And I'm reminded of Christ's passage. A tree is, I'm paraphrasing because I think my paraphrase is clearer than his. I shouldn't say that. what Christ says in the Gospels is, a good tree can only give good fruit and a bad tree gives bad fruit. And that's, I find, ambiguous because you think, oh, well, what if I happen to be a bad tree? There's no choice. I'll just give bad fruit. But I think what Christ is saying is the feature of a tree which is used to characterize it as good or bad is the fruit it gives. So you know whether the tree is good exactly, but there's no way to measure it apart from the fruit. You know, that's how it's measured. So if the fruit of your walk with God is that you love people, it's a good walk with God. Mm. And if it isn't, then it's a walk with something else.
So this actually is addressing, I like the title of this week's lesson, the central issue, love or selfishness. But I feel that there's an interesting aspect to this dichotomy that's being presented, because love or hate would be the conventional opposites. And I'm not even sure that they are perfect opposites, but they are much more conventionally associated in this contrary way. Love or selfishness actually already implies the idea that something about love is unselfish. But that's exactly what this passage in 1 John is emphasizing. The love... Well, maybe
certainly it's emphasizing love. But here's an interesting thought. Is the opposite of selfishness unselfishness? C.S. Lewis had this to say.
Oh, good. I was about to quote C.S. Lewis again, but we may be thinking of the same passage.
He said this: if you ask 20 good men today, remembering when he was writing, and thinking about how that might apply even nearly 100 years down the track, if you ask 20 good men today what they thought the highest of the virtues, 19 of them would reply unselfishness. But if you asked almost any of the great Christians of old, he would have replied love. You see what has happened. A negative term has been substituted for a positive, and this is of more than philological importance. The negative ideal of unselfishness carries with it the suggestion not primarily of securing good things for others, but of going without them for ourselves, as if our abstinence and not their happiness was the important point. That's from The Weight of Glory.
Which is one,
that's so good.
One of my favourite essays. And you think of the prodigal son, the brother who stayed at home. Now, there was a very strong connection in my mind. I'm struggling to draw it now.
He doesn't quite say I've gone without, but he says I've been unselfish.
This guy went and had all the parties, and I didn't. And I didn't do the parties, and I could have.
You see that, and that's it. Mm. It's the absence there. You see, I was unselfish. I didn't do. It's the negative that has been substituted for the good, the positive good. Mm.
The father's response is, "Well, can't you just think of other people's happiness for once?"
Yeah. It's interesting.
Aren't you glad that I'm happy?
In this way, C.S. Lewis's quote is proved correct, or is at least there is evidence what he said is correct in the lesson. So there is a positive in the lesson, because the lesson refers to the early Christian theologian Tertullian.
Was he an Adventist, Ken?
He would have been.
That's such a good answer. I'm sure he would have been. If only he had been presented with the right opportunity of enough truth.
In any event, the lesson says this: love was the norm of Christian communities in the first few centuries. Tertullian, an early Christian theologian, who would have been an Adventist had he had the opportunity, claimed... It is mainly the deeds of a love so noble that lead many to put a brand upon us. See, they say, how they love one another.
That's exactly Christ's words in John, isn't it? This is how all men shall know you as my disciples, that you love one another.
Can I pick up that quoting from John? Because this is one of the things that I get quite worked up about. Often, when Adventists want to talk about commandments, they end up invoking New Testament passages. And they invoke them firmly with the Ten Commandments of either Exodus or Deuteronomy in their mind. But the problem with this is, apart from a couple of references in the Gospels where Jesus is basically saying, you know, you've encountered this commandment, but I'm refreshing it a little bit, all of the instances of the word commandment in the New Testament come from the Gospel of John, or the books of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, or the book of Revelation, which are at least conventionally understood to have arisen from the same author, or at least the same school of thought. And every single one of those carries the essence of that passage in the Gospel of John: a new command I give you, to love one another. So my deeply held conviction is that any time in the New Testament epistles where we read the word commandment, we would do very well to ignore the 10, as useful and interesting as they are, but to focus on the one, which is of love, and of love for God and for our neighbour. And I think it puts a fresh complexion on some of the ways the word commandment has been used and focused on in the New Testament.
And like we talked about this on previous episodes where we talked about mission, but you know, the Great Commission, what's the Great Commission? Well, everyone refers to the end of Matthew. Christ identifies the Great Commission. This is the greatest commandment, that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and that you love your neighbour as yourself. So in Christ's words, that is the Great Commission. The other one's a commission.
The other interesting thing that I'd like to draw out of this is, and we've looked at, we went from saying, well, there's selfishness, and the opposite of selfishness, is not unselfishness, it is love. But in fact, here we have a different conception even of that. Now, I'm not saying there's not a relationship between these two things, but if we go to verse 18, if you're looking for the opposites, if you look at, let me, don't read verse 18 yet. Let me introduce it in this way. I may be wrong as a physicist. Indeed, I'm not a physicist at all, so I will inevitably be wrong as a physicist. When we look at light and darkness, and, you know, we talk about darkness as the absence of light, or is light the absence of darkness. But in any event, so there is this, I'm going to go with darkness is the absence of light. And in that sense, we come across this passage, there is no fear in love. So love is the absence of fear. The opposite of love is fear, not selfishness.
A perfect love casts out fear.
Yeah. So, and when you look at that word, a perfect love casts out, this is the same type of love that is spoken about earlier, this love that is made complete, the love that is made perfect. So it's perfect in the sense that it's complete, it's a whole love. So a complete love is a state of living which has no fear. So really the opposite of love is fear. Now, that's not to say that selfishness has nothing to do with it, because what is the consequence of fear? The consequence of fear is to hang on for me. The consequence of fear is not to think about you, but to look at how my interests can be best advanced. So there's a real connection there. But the real problem is not selfishness. The real problem is fear. Deal with fear, and or at least replace fear with love, and you're not going to have to worry about selfishness.
Yeah. Ken, as a physicist, I think your comments about light and darkness were pretty much spot on. I think it is best to think of darkness as the absence of light. In fact, the author of 1 John uses exactly this kind of metaphor at the very beginning of the book. In John, 1 John chapter 1, verse 5, this is the message we heard from Jesus and now declare to you, God is light and there is no darkness in him at all. And then the metaphor is, or the whole picture is used heaps more. If we say we're lying if we say we have fellowship with God but go on living in spiritual darkness, because basically where there is light there cannot be darkness. This metaphor keeps coming up again and again in this book.
Well, not just this book. It's the theme of John. It's John's theme.
Yes.
When he's talking to Nicodemus in chapter 3 of the Gospel, he says, whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already because he has not believed in the name of God's one and only Son. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. Yep. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God. And what are the sorts of things that are done through God in light? They are love.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting.
And, yeah, and
you got a lot.
I was just going to point out in chapter 2 of 1 John, Jesus, verse 8, Jesus lived the truth of this commandment, and you also are living it, for the darkness is disappearing, and the true light is already shining. There's actually some beauty there, that it doesn't say the darkness has disappeared. I think there's a lot that we don't have time to discuss on this episode that relates to the way that some of this is nuanced with the idea of process and growth. But there's the word commandment again, and many listeners have possibly heard 1 John chapter 2, verse 3, and we can be sure that we know him if we obey his commandments. If anyone claims, I know God, but doesn't obey God's commandments, that person is a liar. I want you to hear that passage mirrored against what we read in this episode in chapter 4, which is, if anyone says, I love God, but doesn't show love to their neighbor, then they're lying. Right? And it's so, so deeply connected. Again, I think sometimes when we read, if you love God, you'll obey his commandments, and are inclined to retrofit some different idea into the word commandments, it can paint a picture of a different kind of view of God and the world. But 1 John is not leaving any room for that. It's unambiguous. You know, even by verse 7 of chapter 2, dear friends, I'm not writing a new commandment for you. Rather, it's an old one you've had from the very beginning. This old commandment to love one another is the same message that you heard before. There's no ambiguity whatsoever.
Isn't there a passage where Christ criticizes the Pharisees for making a life of faith hard for people?
Yeah, you've
added all of these things. Yeah. One wonders what he would say to us if we read the passage in John about the if we love God, we follow the commandments, and retrofit a particular set of commandments that suit us well.
I do want to pick up on that a little bit, because this command to love, that's fine, but that love has to be expressed in particularity, not just in the abstract. And to express it in particularity does require real application. Now, and that means love will be expressed in things like not stealing, not murdering, not coveting, because coveting leads to those other things. And it will be expressed in those ways that are specified, particularized in the Ten Commandments. The problem that we have is that we tend to take the approach of the rich young ruler and say, well, I've done all those things. Tick.
Yeah.
But love doesn't work. Love is not the simple application of rules. Love is the complicated and difficult task of seeking the good of the other in this particular situation.
This is what Christ says in the story of the Good Samaritan, because he is asked the question, who is my neighbour? And his answering question is, in the story I've just told, who was a neighbour? So one of them is, like, can you make the commands more clear in their fine print? And Jesus says, forget the fine print. Flip it on its head. Are you being a neighbour? Are you taking the chance you have to be a neighbour? I have a couple of thoughts, but they might lead in a different direction. So if you've...
I've ridden this hobby horse far enough, but I will just point out, I agree thoroughly with what you're saying, Ken. I think an elegant summary of the Ten Commandments is love God and love each other. And my only critique in this direction is really focused on the way that I think historically it's been possible for people to pick one of the Ten Commandments that they feel particularly passionate about. And then tick that box and then use that as somehow legitimacy to say, I don't have to really worry about taking the others all that seriously because I've proven my allegiance to the Ten Commandments. And I think Adventists have done that with the Sabbath commandment at times. We've said, well, we must be the ones that obey the commandments because we keep the seventh day Sabbath.
When you say we do it at times, Locke, do you mean religiously once a week?
No, I don't know. All I'm commenting is, like, no Adventist is proudly going out and killing and murdering people, but Jesus did pretty clearly say, like you've heard it said, don't murder, but I'm telling you, even harboring grudges and being angry is is not in keeping with the degree of love to which the Tengu moments are in fact calling us. And I just worry sometimes that we can get very distracted by sort of saying, if we love God, then we keep his commandments. And those that the saints love that love God keep his commandments, we must be those people because we keep all 10, tick, box, done. And it may be that in doing so and being slightly glib about it, we really don't honestly face up to the challenge that is being posed by Jesus in any of the passages we've referred to, by 1 John, which really calls us to a far, far more engaged interaction with this theme.
Okay. I've got three things I've saved up. One of them is that there's an Adrian Plass sketch to be performed. We've had C.S. Lewis around Adrian Plass now, in which a Christian author goes to heaven and is trying to get through the pearly gates. And it bars into the rather overdone image of the angel or Peter sitting at the gates checking the criteria of people coming in. And they say, "Who are you?" And the guy says, "I'm a Christian author." And they look a bit blank. And he says, "No, you know, I've been writing books. You know, I wrote a book about this." "Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And you neglected your family while you were doing it. You used to spend hours and hours in the..." And the poor guy's getting more and more distraught. He says, "Yes, but I, you know, what about my landmark article, Hair Length and Holiness, A Study of Beards in the Pentateuch, or something?" And it was hailed as a you know, brave new step towards truth. And the angel says, "Yes, by the Octogenarian Barber Association of Latvia, which only had 3 members, and they died out before they got into their second year running or something." And he's trying to, and the angel pulls out a copy of your books, and he says, "Well, you know, in terms of getting into heaven, it's not so much what you know. It's not even, you know, these books, I'm afraid, won't get you in. It's got to do with Jesus." And the author says, "Oh, yes, I know. I've written about him." And the angel turns to the book and says, "Oh, let's see if he's written about you."
Oh, dear.
That's one thought. The next is, was Jesus an Adventist? And I asked this question. I had an experience in grade 11 in my Bible class where one of the students in the class who'd been an Adventist all her life was scandalized to find out that Jesus was not an Adventist, and was even further scandalized to find out he wasn't a Christian. It was a moment of blank disbelief. And I am not sure, given how at times critical Christ was of the capacity of institutions to represent God. You know, he celebrates people like the Syrophoenician woman and the centurion. He celebrates people. And the people he celebrates, the faith he celebrates, and that he draws attention to, like the woman who was bleeding when he's on the way to the church leader, Christ seems just disconnected from institution. I think it would be dangerous to say that Christ would have been an Adventist if only he'd been given the right Bible study and said the right truth. So I think there's a warning in that for us. The third direction is, you know, we've been talking about contrasting love with things, and I'm reminded of my good friend Brad McClintock, who used to take umbrage with the word opposite. He said the opposite's too hard. What's the opposite of black? Is it white? Or is it the smell of a week old fish that's been left out and gone moldy? And, you know, like what's the opposite? There's so many things in the universe. Pink Floyd's most recent album, you know, the dewdrops glistening on the grass, you know, in the Patagonian sunrise. You know, what is it that's the opposite? Or as Bill Bailey remarked once, the baffling longevity of LinkedIn. Is that the opposite of the color black? You know, so opposite's a bit of a dangerous path to go down. And I am turning to a passage which you think the lesson might want to turn to in a discussion on love. And it provides many opposites to love.
Ah, that's a cool idea.
So love is opposed to impatience, and love is opposed to rudeness and imposition. It's opposed to envy, jealousy. It's opposed to boasting. It's opposed to pride. It's opposed to wishing ill on others, both their person and their reputation. It's opposed to self-seeking. Love is opposed to anger, which is roused easily, which is a fascinating distinction. Love is not easily angered. It's not all anger. Love is opposed to holding grudges. Love is opposed to any celebration of something bad happening to anyone.
Hmm.
Love is opposed to any sort of disappointment that truth is shared. Love always rejoices in the truth. Love is opposed to endangering people. It's opposed to distrusting. It's opposed to despairing. And it's opposed to any of the above, which disappears under difficult times. It is opposed to the disappearance of any of the above under trialing times.
Mm.
So, love has, depending which sort of side you look at it from, it might have many opposites.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea.
What's interesting is, because I resonate strongly with what you said, Ken, about love being opposed to fear, is fear isn't mentioned in the 1 Corinthians 13. That doesn't bother me at all, because obviously each passage can add a new aspect and a new facet and a new light. Mm.
If we reflect on those things, though, and look at what is behind impatience, it's a fear that I will have to wait, that I won't get what I want when I want it. What's behind rudeness? It's perhaps a fear that I won't be given the respect that I think I deserve. What's behind envy? Again, not the timing of what I want, but whether I'll get it at all. The fear of that. The boasting that. There's a fear that people might not realise how good I am. You can see how there's a connect. There's a fear behind all of those things that are not love. I won't use the word opposite, those things that are not love.
So I think we've got to wrap up soon. This is a quarter and a season where we're going to be talking more and regularly about the theme of the great controversy.
Are we? I thought we were, Lockhart.
The existence of potentially many opposites, and of course in an n-dimensional space they might all be orthogonal, so that might be the definition of opposite. Maybe it means that there are many controversies that are all great. There are great controversies, because there's the controversy between love and anger, and between love and impatience, and this is not really all that revolutionary, because in the conventional telling of this theme, I mean, Satan is rude and impatient and like all those things. In other words, we're already more than willing to accept the way that they are all in this particular theme, this narrative. Those things are all sort of embodied narratively, at least.
Yeah.
If not literally and figuratively, but perhaps as well.
Well, I'm going to come full circle now and say, I remarked facetiously that I thought that the passage the lesson directed us to was about how I should treat my co-workers and the people around me more than it was about the great controversy. I think what the passage in John is saying is that the greatest controversy in your life, now, whether this is a local expression of a great controversy, it can be. Let's allow that. But the greatest controversy is between your own fears and desires and the interests of the people you will meet in the immediate future and deal with. That is the great controversy. The great controversy is the gossip in the workplace. It is the backstabbing. It is the discrediting of people. It is the stealing of people. It is the, that is... Because it's so great, your treatment of those, in other words, the local. We think of the big picture and the small picture, but John is actually saying the small one is bigger than the big one. Like how you're treating people, around you encapsulates whether or not the God of universe is living in you. Like, I mean, the small picture is bigger than the big one.
That is so challenging. So true. And so challenging. I mean, all I have to do is look back a little bit on today, not very far back on today, minutes perhaps even before we started this podcast, and certainly I can immediately bring to mind, I hate doing things that aren't particular, just making these generalisations, but I'm actually not prepared to confess in public on this podcast. Yep, I can immediately bring to mind ways in which I have snuffed out the life of God in this world through my failure to live love.
Yeah, in what Cam's described as the small,
in the very story, small and particular story,
but it is correctly labelled as, in fact, the big, the big story. It's the big story. Dear. That's a really interesting challenge. I suggest we leave that challenge hanging for us and for our listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for joining us, listening to this episode. This season promises to be very stimulating. Based on the first two episodes, I'm really enjoying it. We hope it's useful to you. You can email us at sabbathschoolfromhome@gmail.com, and you can share this podcast with anyone who you feel would benefit. It costs nothing to distribute. So share it if so you wish. And join us again next week.